Ohio National Guard troops left this week for Washington, D.C. after the Trump administration requested reinforcements. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, why Governor DeWine made his decision and the criticism he's facing, plus the future of Ohio's voting machines and community reaction to the latest charge in the downtown brawl that's drawn national attention. Joining me now to kick off the news review are Cincinnati Inquirer state politics reporter Jesse Ballmert and Amanda Becker, a reporter for the 19th. Welcome back to both of you.
Always great to join you, Lucy.
Thank you both for being here. Jesse, how many Ohio National Guard troops did Governor Mike DeWine send to D.C.?
Yeah, so the request was for 150 troops from the Ohio National Guard, and that was made a week ago Friday from the Secretary of the Army. And Governor Mike DeWine issued a statement on Saturday the next day saying that he would comply, that he would send these troops to D.C.
Did he offer any additional explanation for that decision?
Yes. So I spoke with the governor on Monday, and he says that this is consistent with other troop deployments that he has had when he is governor. Thinking back to when the cities of Columbus and Cleveland requested some assistance after protests following George Floyd's murder a few years ago. Ohio has also deployed National Guard to hurricane relief in North Carolina and other states. And so DeWine says that this is the right thing to do.
And what will the Ohio troops be doing in D.C., Jesse?
Yeah, so the governor says that they will be protecting like federal buildings and then also kind of assisting the DC National Guard. He said that Ohio National Guard would not be doing actual arrests, but they would be in contact with local law enforcement to do that if needed.
Amanda, President Trump has made the argument that these troops are needed in D.C. to reduce crime in Washington, D.C. What do the crime statistics there show?
Yeah, so, you know, D.C., like many large cities, in the first couple of years of the COVID-19 pandemic, did see a crime spike, but it's been dropping ever since. Total violent crime last year in the District of Columbia was down 35% over the year before. And so far into this year, it's down even more when you look at like the day-to-day statistics in terms of the first half of 2025. So there really isn't a crime reason. And I do think it's important to note that this was not asked for. Usually when the National Guard is brought in, it's at the request of a governor. D.C., of course, does not have a governor. Our mayor and our city government there have a kind of dual responsibility in terms of federal and city and state. And so this is the first time in 60 years that National Guard has been sent somewhere where it was not requested by the governor there.
Amanda, do you know how noticeable the presence of these National Guard troops is in D.C., just how where they are and kind of how visible they are?
Yeah, so they seem to be concentrated in two areas. There are, of course, some of the National Guard is near the National Mall area and where all the museums are and the tourists go. And, you know, there has been discussion of whether this is perhaps because that's the area of the city that the president sees when he comes out in his motorcade. The White House is right down the street from all these locations. And so it also, you know, creates a really powerful visual if you see military with our iconic monuments and museums in the background. The other area, and I should note before moving on, actually, that is not an area known for crime in D.C. So if you were focused on crime, the National Mall and the museums and the monuments would not be the place that you would probably focus on if you were wanting to kind of crack down on violent crime. The other area where we're seeing a lot of activity is in a neighborhood called Mount Pleasant and Columbia Heights. This is in the northwest quadrant of D.C. It's a city divided into quadrants. I lived in this quadrant for 17 years, so I'm very familiar with it. And this is an area up and down 14th Street that is heavily, a lot of Latino immigrants. It's a lot of Latino businesses. And we are seeing, that's where we're seeing kind of the checkpoints and confrontations with D.C. residents.
Jesse, I know Governor DeWine has faced criticism for his decision to send Ohio National Guard troops to D.C. Explain who's criticizing him and what those criticisms are.
Yeah, so there was a group that had a news conference, folks like the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, Common Cause Ohio, which is kind of like a good government group. And there was a former Democratic state lawmaker who attended as well. There was also a small protest over the weekend at the Ohio State House. And some of the criticism is this was optional. Governor Mike DeWine didn't have to send the Ohio National Guard to help the DC National Guard in response to what many are, you know, critics are calling like this fake political crisis. And other, even Republican governors did not send troops. So he is kind of in the minority of governors that heeded this call. Other criticism is concern that this could be a slippery slope. If you start deploying troops to address crime in one city, could that be deployed in other places across the country?
I guess even in Ohio, possibly. Jesse, how has Governor DeWine responded to these criticisms that he's, you know, taking part in a political crisis that might not exist?
Yeah, his position has really been that he responds to requests for help, and that's consistent with what he has done in the past. As Amanda pointed out, the DC mayor didn't request for these troops. It's not something that like the people and the government and local officials in DC are asking for. But DeWine says that the DC National Guard has the ability and the authority to make this request of governors like him.
Are there any concerns, Jesse, that President Trump might want to send National Guard troops to Cincinnati or other Ohio cities? Cincinnati's certainly been in the news lately for a brawl that happened downtown in late July that we're going to talk about later in the program. Are there any concerns about that?
Yeah, I think certainly the ACLU and critics of this move are concerned about cities, in particular Cincinnati, because of the attention from that viral brawl downtown and just the political response to it. Governor DeWine says that there's no plans to send the Ohio National Guard to Cincinnati, that wasn't part of his talks and offer of support to Cincinnati leaders. But I think that is certainly something in the backs of the minds of critics and opponents to this particular move.
Amanda, can you tell us more about how D.C. authorities are reacting to this National Guard presence? I've heard some kind of mixed messages. I thought I heard that the police chief there initially was kind of grateful that there was some extra help for her team. The mayor has not been so grateful.
Yeah, so it is mixed. And here's the thing, DC has in the past had leaders who wanted more help from the federal government. They didn't necessarily want a takeover, though, of their powers and kind of ceding their power to this administration. And, you know, DC now, the president is saying he wants it to get $2 billion for a Washington beautification plan. One of the reasons I lived in Washington so long is because it is such a beautiful city. And I would note that Congress clawed back over $1 billion earlier this year from DC's budget. And so they clawed back $1 billion. So the city is unable to spend the money that it was supposed to have in its budget to go towards things, towards public safety, schools. And now they're saying they're going to launch a $2 billion beautification plan that the city and its leaders and its residents didn't ask the federal government for. And I would also note in terms of other cities where this may happen, not only are there cities, including in Ohio, that have higher violent crime rates than D.C., including Cleveland, the other cities that Trump has explicitly said he'd like to go into next are Baltimore, Los Angeles, Oakland, New York, and Chicago. And I would note that all of these cities have a couple things in common. First of all, they're all, very blue liberal-leaning cities in blue liberal-leaning states. And they're also all led by Black mayors, including D.C. And so there are also some very nuanced kind of political and racial elements to what is happening right now as well.
Amanda, you explained to us earlier that violent crime, you know, is down in D.C. You just mentioned that it's higher in some other places around the country. What is the perception of crime in D.C. or violent crime in D.C.? We're seeing here in Cincinnati that
different neighborhoods have different levels of crime, that perceptions of residents don't always match up with what the data shows.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really depends, I think, if you're outside D.C. and don't live there and watching the news, or if you live in D.C. If you live in D.C., you're used to a certain level of a particularly property crime. That's a part of living in any large, dense city. But I have to say, as somebody who lived in D.C. for so long, there is not a single neighborhood in D.C. that I don't feel comfortable walking through. And I think that residents there have really noticed kind of the improvements in violent crime over the past couple of years after kind of this time during the pandemic when it felt quite high because everyone was kind of trapped at home and not going anywhere. And so if you're a resident living in D.C. Right now in terms of crime, I don't know many people that are worried about violent crime on a day-to-day basis who live in D.C. Now, also in terms of the National Guard and other kind of federal law enforcement there, how you're experiencing that as a DC resident is really different depending on where you live. If you live in like the area I talked about earlier, Mount Pleasant, Columbia Heights, 14th Street area, U Street, you're seeing this activity. If you live in other areas of the city, you're not seeing this at all. And so it's a really different experience depending on where you are in the city in terms of how you're experiencing crime, but even more so kind of this militarized situation that's happening here with all of the troops coming in and federal law enforcement.
President Trump is certainly saying he feels a lot safer because of this effort, and he seems to be wanting to say this is a remarkable improvement with the Guard here. What changes, I don't know if you've looked at what changes in crime statistics DC has seen since this effort.
I mean, it's only been a week. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this week under the headline, Trump's law and order push in D.C. looks a lot like an immigration raid, that more than half of the arrests so far have been of people in the country illegally, not necessarily people accused of violent crime. Now, D.C., like a lot of liberal cities, is a sanctuary city. They have decided not to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement officials, much like Los Angeles and some other cities we've seen kind of Trump talking about recently. You know, I don't think there's been any noticeable drop in crime. First of all, it's only been a week. Second of all, they don't seem to be arresting people who are committing violent crimes. And actually, just this week, the U.S. attorney, Jeanine Pirro in D.C., who kind of handles, because of D.C.'s unique situation, she handles both local and federal crime prosecutions there. She said it was going to make it easier to possess rifles and shotguns in D.C. It's currently illegal. She said she's not going to prosecute those. If crime is an issue in a city, I don't know the rationale behind making it easier to possess guns.
Jesse, do you know how long Ohio troops will be in D.C.?
Yeah, so it's a 30-day assignment. The governor says that the Secretary of the Army can request for an extension, but it's really too early to know if it would go on beyond that point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because they're just getting there, I guess. They just left this week. And how much does the deployment cost? This is something one of our listeners wanted to know. Is this going to cost Ohio taxpayers?
Yeah. So on deployments like this, it's covered by the federal government, which, of course, we're paying taxes to both federal and state governments. So it could hit you one way or the other. But there isn't like an exact dollar amount that the state of Ohio is going to be paying because of this deployment.
I can say on the federal level, Lucy, I looked into this. Nonpartisan research groups are estimating it will cost about $1 million a day to have 2,000 troops in the city.
$1 million a day and 2,000 troops, is that what's there now, or is that the goal to get that many?
That's what they will be approaching when the various National Guards from the six states that have agreed to send them have their troops on the ground.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for your time. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer, state politics reporter Jesse Balmert, and Amanda Becker, a reporter for the 19th. I really appreciate your time today, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, Ohio's voting machines are facing new scrutiny. This is Cincinnati Edition. an Ohio Supreme Court justice wanted to run for another seat on the court before his term was up. Now he's changed his mind. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about that and other Ohio news are Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson and Signal Ohio reporter Andrew Tobias. Welcome back, Sarah and Andrew.
Hey, happy Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, happy Friday to both of you, too. Sarah, before we get to this Ohio Supreme Court justice, I want to talk about voting machines. President Trump wants to get rid of voting machines. Which machines is he talking about, and why has he said he wants to get rid of them?
So there has been, a lot of scrutiny coming from the right over voting machines, over mail-in ballots, just different ways that we have become accustomed to voting in the last couple of decades. You've seen this in prior elections, and of course, we're gearing up for the 2026 election. So President Trump is again making some of these unfounded claims, but they don't come out of nowhere. You see folks on the ground in Ohio as well who have said for a different number of reasons that they're not super supportive of having voting machines, particularly in small rural counties where it might be expensive to maintain the machines.
How many counties in Ohio use these machines, Sarah?
So there's a mix. Ohio's 88 counties all use some form of electronic tabulation, but there are different kinds of machines. So, if you've voted in different counties in Ohio, and I have, when I was a college student, I'd vote down in Athens County. Now I vote in Franklin County. So we used different types of machines. Some of them are the ones where you're actually selecting who you're voting for on the screen. Some of them are, you're going to fill out a paper ballot, and then you're going to put that paper ballot through a machine. So different counties have different machines, but Secretary of State Frank LaRose tells me all of Ohio's 88 counties have some form of electronic tabulation tied to their voting.
And Sarah, are paper ballots always part of the process, even with the voting machines where you don't use them and put them in the machine?
Secretary of State Frank LaRose tells me yes, because of how Ohio's election audit system works. So there's still a paper trail attached to everybody's vote, because a lot of these, even if they're entirely electronic from the start, there's going to be a paper audit on the back end.
Well, Secretary LaRose thinks moving away from voting machines is a bad idea.
They want elections to be more secure. If you exclusively hand-counted ballots, it would be less secure, because right now what we have is a redundant process where they're counted electronically for that result on election night, and then they're counted as part of a post-election audit by hand.
Andrew, what more has Secretary of State Frank LaRose told you about all of this?
I mean, it's very similar to what he said there. It's interesting because as a Republican who wants to get Donald Trump's endorsement anytime he runs for office, he gets pressure from these elements of the right that are suspicious about these types of voting methods. But he's stating in clear terms that the machines are secure, that there's a paper trail, that audits conducted after the election find 99.99% accuracy, which, just to explain the audits really quickly, without getting into the details, they don't audit every vote. They either pull a percentage or a statistically significant sample, and there are ways actually they can test more and more ballots and audit them if it's a closer race especially. But anyways, he is emphasizing that Ohio's elections are accurate, and is, interesting because in some ways, I guess it might politically benefit him to play along more with some of this kind of stuff, but that's what he's saying.
Hmm. Sarah, you mentioned rural counties in Ohio earlier. There were a couple of rural counties that wanted to move away from voting machines. Tell us more about that and how Secretary LaRose has responded to that.
Yeah, so I know both Andrew and I have reported on this, and I saw even some more reporting from Cleveland.com by Anna Staver today that this fight may still be ongoing. But Seneca and Monroe counties, there were groups there who were collecting signatures to put a question before voters about whether that county should get you know, consider getting rid of its voting machines. Their argument was that when voting machines were first ushered in a couple of decades ago, there was this mechanism that was put on the ballot to ask voters if they wanted to use voting machines. And they think that the reverse should be true. Secretary of State Frank LaRose and his legal team disagree. They don't think there's really like a take-backsies mechanism, and that while county boards of elections, which are typically of very small, I think it's four folks, bipartisan group, they could vote on whether to get rid of voting machines, he thinks. That's what Secretary of State Frank LaRose tells me. But this isn't something that could technically be put directly before voters under Ohio's law.
Sarah, has he gotten criticism for that position to say, no, you can't do this?
He certainly has, especially from folks on the right who have been critical of voting machines. You look at someone like Secretary of State candidate Marcel Stribich. He is running for Secretary of State. He definitely, I would say, leans to the right of LaRose, but he's, you know, criticized LaRose for not hearing out some of these complaints that groups have about voting machines.
Andrew, you referenced President Trump before and how, you know, Republican candidates typically are seeking an endorsement from him. He's very popular in Ohio. How has Secretary LaRose responded to President Trump's statements directly about this executive order to ban voting machines and mail-in voting? Has he spoken about that directly?
So I have not talked with him since the president went off on voting machines on social media. But his office issued what I would describe as a carefully worded statement. I'll read it now. It says, "We look forward to reviewing the details of what the president is proposing. Changes to Ohio's voting process require a vote of the General Assembly, so I'm sure we'll be talking to them as well. So make of that what you will." But that's what he said.
Okay.
Through a spokesperson.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, let's shift to another statewide elected official, Ohio Supreme Court Justice Pat Fisher. He's a Republican. He talked about challenging Justice Jennifer Brunner, who's a Democrat, but his seat wasn't up for re-election. Why was he considering that?
So in Ohio, if you are a judge, or if you're thinking about running to be a judge, if you are 70 years old or older, you are ineligible to hold the office and you're ineligible to run. And so Justice Fisher will not be eligible to run for re-election when his term expires in a few years. And so he got the idea to instead challenge Jennifer Brunner in next year's election, which would allow him to serve a few more years, because you're allowed to hold the office after you are 70 years old, but you're not allowed to run for it. So, you know, he disputes when I spoke with him that motivated him. He said that given that he got the most votes in the 2022 election of the various Ohio Supreme Court candidates, that he felt that he would be the best suited to take Brunner on next year. He thought he's the strongest candidate, but it's hard to escape the fact also that it would allow him to serve his term, another term.
Hmm. Andrew, what was the reaction to that plan? Did he face any criticism for that?
So there are many candidates running for Ohio Supreme Court next year in the Republican side, and I think that kind of speaks to their confidence that they think they can pick that seat up. I believe the number now is four. The field was as high as six, but a couple dropped out, including Fisher, which we can get to. So some of his fellow candidates were raising concerns about that. And I think this process, you know, this is pretty early on and it's kind of inside baseball and politics, but there was a committee of members of the Ohio Republican Party Central Committee. So I guess like a select group that were involved with screening candidates for potential party endorsement, and Fisher failed to get that recommendation. And he agreed that the controversy over this seat switching issue probably played into it. So yes, it seems to have harmed him in this process, but also it's definitely something that his opponents in the Republican primary were making hay out of as well.
Hmm. Sarah, is that why, you know, Andrew just mentioned that he is no longer running for this seat. Is that why Justice Fisher dropped out, because he didn't get that endorsement?
I'm pretty sure he said if the Republican Party did not endorse him, he would drop out. And I know I spoke to some sources ahead of that vote, you know, because there was a question, like Andrew said, this is a pretty busy Republican primary right now. So there are, of course, candidates, and then there are folks lobbying for those candidates. There are folks behind those candidates. So I know that there was, you know, some conversations happening about why the party should endorse in the primary, because this also came up during the party's endorsement of Vivek Ramaswamy, because sometimes when the party endorses in a primary, that is going to force other candidates out of the race. But in this case, Fisher had said, I'm going to drop out if they don't endorse me, and they didn't endorse him. So,
So Andrew, who did the that Republican Party panel endorse instead?
So his name is Ron Lewis. He is a judge on the Second District Ohio Court of Appeals. He is a former senior law director. He held a number of positions in the Xenia government, and he goes back with Mike DeWine. They're personal friends, and DeWine actually appointed him to the seat that he currently holds. And the committee hasn't yet endorsed him, but this, you know, special group recommended him for the endorsement, and it should carry enough weight for him to get the endorsement. Although we'll see. It's the meeting will be next month, and we'll find out what happens.
I see. Sarah, go ahead, Sarah.
I was just going to say, I've definitely noticed, and I think Andrew mentioned this, but I have noticed, you know, some level of support as well for Fifth District Court of Appeals Judge Andrew King. I've seen a number of Republicans throw their support behind him. And of course, that's not necessarily who that small panel voted to endorse, but I have seen a number of elected Republicans, you know, speaking out for him as well. So certainly not necessarily a done deal.
Andrew, so do you think there still will be a Republican primary in that race, or is it too soon to tell?
We'll see. It's customary, I guess, for, in a sense, kind of funny to talk about politics this way, given how much things have changed, but it's customary for when the Ohio Republican Party makes an endorsement that the other candidates do drop out. We've seen in the past, there was a race in 2016. It was actually, I believe, when Fisher was elected for the first time. There was another candidate who remained in the race and ended up losing. But the reason why the party holds so much sway over this, when I would say that politics in general have become more candidate driven, is that judicial candidates are restricted from what they're allowed to say and campaign on due to judicial ethics rules. They're not allowed to, for instance, talk about cases upon which they might rule. Also, generally speaking, people aren't as knowledgeable about judicial races. They often fly under the radar. So something like a party endorsement can really carry a lot of weight with voters who may not have a strong opinion about it otherwise.
Sarah, Justice Berner is the only Democrat in Ohio to hold statewide office. Do you think it's going to be difficult for her to hold on to that seat, no matter who the Republican challenger ends up being?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think you just have to go back to the fact that these Supreme Court races have only for a short period of time been run with party labels next to the candidates' names. For a long time, candidates were running and they didn't have party labels next to their names, but that changed. I don't want to say how many election cycles ago, but it hasn't been very long. And of course, you know, there were three contested races in 2024. There were three Democratic candidates and three Republican candidates, and all three Republicans came out on top. Trump was on the ballot, but, you know, when you're talking about down ballot races, and of course, the Ohio Supreme Court is an incredibly important role in the broader realm of state government. But, you know, when you're talking about the average voter, they're probably going because they know they have a candidate on the ballot they really like, and it might be Senate, it might be governor. I don't know how much folks are really going out to vote on the Supreme Court race. So sometimes that R or that D next to someone's name is going to be the deciding factor.
Andrew, what do you think? Does she have an uphill battle ahead?
I think it'll all come down to what the national political environment is, but I think it would be a real shift for, even in a really strong Democratic year nationally, for Ohio to suddenly be a positive, you know, net positive Democratic environment. And like I said, judges are restricted in what they're allowed to say as they campaign. Voters might not be as knowledgeable about who the candidates are. And so it's really hard if you're a Democrat you know, running uphill to make the argument about exactly how you might differ from other Democratic candidates. It can be harder to, or to, you know, other Democrats out there. It's just harder to get voters to split the ticket if they're just more inclined to view you as a generic member of your party, which is often the case with how these races transpire.
Well, Andrew, let's stick with the judicial theme we're on. Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for governor in Ohio, of course, said he wants to revive a state database that tracks judges' sentencing decisions. Can you explain what that database is or was?
Sure. So in Ohio, the courts, you know, as far as that actually convict people of crimes or acquit them, of course, are operated at the county level. So there's 88 counties in Ohio, which means that more or less, there are 88 sets of courts. I think maybe some counties may have like consolidated administration. I guess I'll just caveat. I'm not sure if that's the case, but more or less, that's true. And so the result of that is that if I'm a member of the legislature or a researcher working for the legislature, if I'm an advocate, or I don't have to be hypothetical about this one, I am a journalist. It can be difficult to make conclusions about what judges are actually doing and to kind of put them into context. So are certain judges handling a particular type of crime differently than their counterparts? Are different kinds of defendants getting treated differently depending on where they're accused of committing their crime? And so that the information is all kept locally, but you would have to go through 88 sets of records and kind of comb through and assemble the information manually. And so it was an idea that kind of existed before this, but it really took off in 2020, I think, amid kind of like a broader national conversation about social justice and racial equity and things like that. The court then, under the then leadership of then Republican Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, started a project to basically put a database together that the state would run, that the individual courts would report into it. Like with anything involving government bureaucracy, it's more complicated than it sounds because you have to get 88 counties to have a standardized way of reporting how people, what kind of information, you know, they're writing down about how people are sentenced. If it's not typed out the same way, you can't make broad conclusions about it. Like I've encountered this with voter files. If some counties put an apostrophe between an Irish name like O'Connor and some don't, it can make it difficult to know who the O'Connors are, for example. So that was a big, long process. Ultimately, the court did not force local judges to cooperate, and they kind of complained that they found it was unwieldy. And I mean, frankly, I think there's a lot of political opposition too from judges who are concerned about getting called out about a particular sentence, you know, maybe unfairly if they thought that the public didn't know enough about the circumstances behind the case. So this whole thing kind of went on for a few years. I'm talking a lot, but it was a campaign issue in 2022. The Republican Chief Justice, actually, I'm sorry, I believe it was 2024. Sharon Kennedy, who is the Republican Chief Justice candidate, campaigned against it more or less, and Democratic candidates campaigned for it. Once Kennedy won office, she basically pulled the plug on the project. So that is a brief history of that project. I'm sorry that took so long.
Oh, no. No, that was very helpful. So the state kind of used it for a while, stopped using it. What has Vivek Ramaswamy said about why he wants to bring it back?
So that's, I found it interesting. I was at a political event that Ramaswamy had in Cincinnati. It was about that whole street brawl thing that he basically convened a town hall on public safety issues. And he kind of was coming at it from the standpoint of, you know, these soft on crime judges, they're letting people walk free, and voters need to know more about the bail conditions that they're setting for people accused of serious crimes so they can vote them out of office when the time comes. Apparently, this database came up in his conversation with city officials while he was there. So I don't know how much of the background he really knew about that project and why it, you know, didn't succeed and what, you know, kind of the pros and cons were and the players and stuff like that. But he essentially said, I think this is a great idea. If I'm elected, it'll be my number one priority to bring more transparency to this process. And so I wrote a story kind of highlighting that, especially given that the Republican judicial candidates generally oppose this thing actually being created.
Right. It's really interesting because you mentioned when this first came up, the idea was, you know, racial justice and looking at sentencing equity and that sort of thing. He's saying that this could be more of a tough on crime, you know, way of looking at judges. So in 2022, this was something Democrats were for and Republicans were against. Vivek Ramaswamy, of course, is a Republican. Do you have any thoughts about how this might shake out this time around, or if this will even become a big issue in this whole race?
So I haven't covered Ramaswamy long enough to know if when he calls something his number one priority in a public event, if he's just kind of vibing and just kind of saying what feels good, or whether that's actually a policy proposal. I get the impression it was a little bit more of floating it out there and kind of seeing what people said. You know, he is somebody who does throw ideas out and kind of, you know, he's a little bit less guarded, I think, than some other politicians have been in the past. So his campaign walked it back a little bit. They said that he's open to talking about this. They specifically said that he opposed the idea of, you know, constructing a system like this specifically to look at the racial demographics of people accused of crime. So I don't know if that means that he would not want to collect that information, or if maybe it's just a matter of emphasis. I don't know enough about kind of filling in, you know, all the details of all this stuff. But if Ramaswamy decides to take this up, I think that he's the kind of person who could put a little bit more energy and, you know, kind of motivating some of the local judges to get in line behind it. But Ohio's, you know, a decentralized state. We have lots and lots of different local governments, and the challenge of, you know, getting everybody on the same page politically, recording information, it's a longstanding issue that other governors have dealt with in the past. It'll be interesting to see how it may affect him if, in fact, he gets elected.
Yeah. We will certainly keep watching that. I've been talking with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson and Signal Ohio reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, we will hear the latest charges in the downtown Cincinnati brawl that got national attention. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A brawl in downtown Cincinnati that happened late last month drew national attention, and the community continues to react to the police response. Joining me now to discuss the latest charge and community reaction is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferraro. Welcome back, David.
Good afternoon, Lucy.
Great to have you here. We have been talking now for weeks about this brawl in downtown Cincinnati. It happened in late July. A white man who was beaten up during the brawl has been charged. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What's he been charged with?
Yeah, that's right. So Alex Travinsky is the eighth suspect. We have sources that confirmed to us that this is the man who was charged. And it appears that he was the person who dealt the slap that escalated the verbal confrontation into a brawl. He's facing a low-level misdemeanor, a disorderly conduct charge, and he is the eighth person out of the seven, or were the seven folks that have been charged with felonies, and he's the eighth person now to be charged with just a misdemeanor.
Okay. And we should mention that the police haven't released his name officially. I think they're saying because he also was a victim he got beaten pretty severely, that Marcy's Law covers him, and that's why they haven't released his name.
That's right. Marcy's Law, the state law in Ohio that protects crime victims from having their names released by public agencies.
Now, Black community leaders had been calling on police to charge the man. Can you talk a little bit about what was behind those calls to charge him with something?
Yeah, absolutely. So out of the eight folks so far, obviously with Mr. Travinsky being the eighth, the seven folks so far who have been charged besides him are all Black. Alex is white. So Black leaders in the community have looked at the charge, just a disorderly conduct misdemeanor, as not enough. Mm-hmm. There was a rally yesterday that was led by Reverend David Lynch III, who made calls for additional charges, saying that this wasn't enough. The primary rallying call was looking for equal application of the law. The charge that Mr. Travinsky faces is just a misdemeanor, 30 days max in jail, but most of the time folks get off with just a fine. Whereas the charges that a lot of the other folks are facing are felony level, aggravated assault, aggravated riot, and some other charges that could actually face prison time.
Well, we have some audio from Pastor Lynch. He spoke to our news partner, WCPO, and as you said this latest suspect should face more serious charges.
He decided to walk forward, re-engage, and then slap somebody in the face, which brought about the aggravated rioting and the brawl. He should be charged for that.
Cincinnati FOP President Ken Kober told WCPO that he questions the charges.
Why are we waiting 6 weeks to sign a misdemeanor of the fourth degree? I mean, it's very, very easy for the public to see that this is politically motivated.
Clearly some very divided opinions. FOP President Ken Kober has said the city's solicitor's office pushed for this charge to be filed. Has the city administration responded about whether there was pressure from the solicitor's office to file this charge?
We did hear a little bit from a city spokeswoman, Molly Lair, who denied that that was the case, said that the solicitor regularly collaborates with the police department, provides legal guidance, guidance on probable cause and such, but the solicitor did not order any charges.
Okay. I know there have been a lot of people on the Inquirer's news team who have been covering this story, so I guess I wonder, does charging this man, who was also a victim in this beating, could it have an impact on how the other people who were charged will be prosecuted? I mean, does that complicate things?
It does complicate things. One of my colleagues spoke with a retired prosecutor who had said that, you know, prosecuting a victim could lead to impacting the testimony in the other felony level cases, because if called upon, this man could claim his Fifth Amendment right to not self-incriminate, which could affect the evidence in the other cases as well as his own.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, there was this rally held on Fountain Square yesterday. You said that Pastor Lynch was the person who kind of organized it and was a leader behind it. Tell us more about the reason behind this rally.
Right. So Cincinnati, as we've all known, right, has entered the spotlight on both a local level with a lot of folks talking about this brawl, but also on a national level. You have politicians that have descended upon Cincinnati, both statewide and national, and looking towards making this as a bit of a rallying call. You have politicians that I believe you just spoke with someone about how Vivek Ramaswamy held the town hall. You have Senator Bernie Moreno, who has spoken about crime in Cincinnati and how that's going to impact his policies and going forward, such like that. So there was a lot of criticism of how this has been politicized. The pastor was quoted as saying, you know, it's been politicized, it's been racialized, and our city deserves better. And, you know, I think a lot of this, especially on the verge of, or on the eve of, let me rephrase that, after seeing that the eighth person was charged with a lesser charge, has a lot of folks in the Black community in particular upset, seeing as he was the person who started the fight. There was a sign at the rally yesterday that stuck out to me that said, "No slap, no scrap." And I think that is a sort of sign that a lot of folks in the community are seeing this as, had this man's actions not taken place, this wouldn't even be a conversation right now.
Mm. So if he hadn't slapped one of the other people who was there, there wouldn't have been this big brawl to begin with.
That's right.
The idea. Roughly how many people were at this rally?
I counted about between 50 to 60. The crowd grew as time went on. There was another event going on at Fountain Square at the same time, but you also had a lot of folks that convened around as the rally continued. Folks from different parts of the Black community, different churches. There was a rabbi that spoke. There was a Muslim woman who spoke on behalf of her congregation. So you had a lot of different folks from a lot of different walks of life speaking out.
Yeah. Tell us, we've heard what Pastor Lynch had to say. What did some of the other speakers at the rally have to say? How did they lend their voices to this?
Generally, similar thoughts and similar additions, I would say, that a lot of folks at the rally expressed, you know, there's the possibility for additional charges and the possibility for, again, making sure that the law is applied equally. I think that's what really stuck out for a lot of folks, was that there seems to be a discrepancy here.
Mm-hmm. Were there any people demonstrating against the rally? We heard that, you know, FOP President Ken Cooper obviously he thinks the opposite of these charges, that this white man who slapped the other person shouldn't have been charged. Were there any counter demonstrations?
Not that I saw, no.
Okay. It seems like politicians and community leaders are divided on how they see this brawl. Do you have a sense whether the community is divided? There have been a lot of letters to the editor coming in to the Inquirer that look at this from all different sides. It seems like not everybody's on the same page about this.
Right. And I think a lot of the conversation has to do with the crime that folks have been witnessing in Cincinnati this summer. This is, you know, not necessarily been representative of the situation in Cincinnati in terms of the crime numbers, because there has been an uptick in the urban core with downtown and over the Rhine, primarily in property crime, though. So when you see a video of a brawl online, that's not necessarily depictive of what's going to happen when you go downtown on a Friday night.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of folks are on one side of the situation saying that, and you have a lot of folks on the other side that are saying, no, you can't descend upon downtown, it's not safe, I wouldn't even go there during the daytime. And there's sort of a difference in perception versus what the numbers are showing. And that's something that I think is kind of becoming central to the narrative here, is what's going on in people's minds and what's actually going on the ground.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you brought up the numbers. We've talked about the data on the show before several times, but just to reiterate, you mentioned that crime is up, especially property crime in downtown and over the Rhine, but overall in the city, the data shows a different picture, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Citywide, you know, there's a slight uptick in violent crime and about the same as last year when it comes to around property crime. It's just where this crime is occurring. So when you actually look at some of the numbers, you'll see that, you know, in downtown and over the Rhine, there is an uptick in property crime, a large uptick over last year. That's about come back to normal, to last year's numbers to say. But then in other neighborhoods such as Avondale, violent crime has actually been down this year. So there, it seems to be that certain neighborhoods, for reasons unknown, are experiencing different upticks and decreases in crime. And I think that especially when it comes to, you see these high profile events such as the brawl downtown, or you had the shooting of an innocent bystander over the Rhine a couple of weeks ago, you know, these high profile events catch people's attention and sort of lead to that perception of crime being possibly worse than it is.
Yeah. The city has adopted different strategies to try to deal with crime. And one of them has been this changed curfew for young people. The idea being that, you know, kids over a certain age shouldn't be congregating late at night. Bad things can happen. Tell us what happened. This was the first week for that new curfew. Just this, I guess, this past weekend was. What did you find? What happened with that?
So according to Cincinnati Police, not too much. So the police did not give out any citations for the curfew, didn't have to redirect any juveniles to the youth centers that they established for curfew violators. But that kind of lines up with what the city's policy is for enforcing the curfew. I mean, the curfew has been on the books for nearly three decades now. And the idea of even having curfew centers is not a new idea. This was something that was done back in the 90s when the curfew was first established. But this time around, the goal is to not redirect kids to the juvenile court, not to have to detain kids and bring them to a curfew center. It's to ask them, tell them, hey, you're past curfew, please go home. If they don't, get them to a curfew center. And if they're still not complying, then you demand it and you take that further action.
Mm-hmm. And can you remind us what's changed about the curfew? Because as I understand it, it was a little bit more complicated in these previous iterations, but it's gotten a little bit more streamlined.
Right. So they tried to simplify it. So citywide, a general way to look at it, citywide, it's an 11 p.m. curfew for anyone under the age of 18, unaccompanied by a parent or guardian. But in the special curfew district they established, which is downtown and over the Rhine, south of Liberty Street, it's 9 p.m. every night for anyone under the age of 18.
Okay. So that's important for young people and their parents and guardians to know about that timing. Did Pastor Lynch mention that he has anything else planned in terms of these rallies or...
Last I heard, there was a community meeting expected at New Prospect Church next Tuesday. However, not a lot of details were added about that.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Farrar. Thank you so much for your time today, David. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a good weekend.